You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oran Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there. Tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode was produced thanks to our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek. Welcome to another episode of the Mythgreens Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is
Wes.
And joining us for the first time is a special guest, Ari.
Hello, everyone. It's nice to be here.
Welcome, Ari.
If Ari sounds similar to me, that is completely coincidental, and we are absolutely not related at all. Don't let anything convince you otherwise.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I barely know these people. They just picked me up off the street and told me we were going to talk about some nerd stuff, so now I'm here.
Yeah, I heard you were a real nerd. What kind of nerd stuff do you do?
I do all sorts of nerd stuff. I play all the board games, and I play lots of video games. Before the show, we were just talking about some of the fun stuff. I've been replaying the Dragon Age series and trying to get through it with one character on the hardest difficulty, so that's been fun.
I was going to say, did you follow all the advice on that and you're going Arcane Warrior Elf?
Nope, I'm a Bow Rogue.
Oh, dear.
I've never played a Rogue before, and I've never played an Archer before, so I figured I didn't want to be near anything, because being near stuff is how they kill you, so I would be as far away from my enemies as possible.
So you're basically kiting the world.
I abuse the stealth skill, because when you're by yourself, stealth is really powerful. But I'm using a whole bunch of skills I've never touched. I'm using like grenades and traps, just all parts of the game that I just never use, because you don't need them when you have a full party. It doesn't matter what difficulty you're playing on. So it's been fun. It's been a very different experience playing this game with this mode, which is kind of the idea of these challenge runs.
Right.
But yeah, besides that, just playing the Hearthstone expansion just dropped, so I've been playing a lot of that, trying to get to Legend. You know, just the general nerd stuff.
Yeah, and I also know that you read a lot of fantasy and science fiction books, and you read the same ones like over and over again. I have noticed this.
Yes, this is correct. When I find a book series that I like, I will read it over and over again, because for whatever reason, I have a really hard time starting new series. I will oftentimes take long breaks where I don't read anything because I finished a series and I just, for whatever reason, have a hard time picking up a new one. Once I start, it's generally fine. Like with Expanse, the Expanse series is probably the most recent one that I've been reading. But it took me about like 2 months from when I like picked up the first book to actually start reading them seriously. It's very strange.
I was going to say, do you find that when you end up rereading them, Mari, like, are you looking for something new, or are you just wanting to kind of experience the story and the characters again?
I just like the stories. The series that I reread, we're going to be diving into those a bit more, but there's basically two series, which is the Honorverse, which is a hard science fiction space opera. And then there's the Dresden Files, which is, you know, like noir, urban fantasy magic. And I just really like these are the kinds of series that even when I reread them, the emotional portions of the story still get me emotional. And I like the twists and the turns they take, even though I know they're coming. And with the Honorverse, it's a long enough series that even by the time you finish it, you may have forgotten what happened in the beginning. So we will talk about that later.
Yeah, and that is actually our topic for today, is a long book series. And this is probably going to end up being a two-part episode, because as the book series are long, so are the number of them that we have read. So to define what I at least mean by a long book series is usually something that goes beyond the standard trilogy, and that can mean either more books or just a really long trilogy. Like Lord of the Rings, for example, just has a very high word count, even though it's three books. It certainly strikes me as much longer than your standard fantasy or sci-fi trilogy.
Okay.
The Stormlight Archives. I don't actually know if Brandon Sanderson is finished with the third book of that series yet, but the first two are monsters, and so if the third one is the same size, I would also count that as being a very long, very long series.
One maybe silly question here. I was thinking while we were prepping this on what constitutes a series, because I was starting to think, okay, does it have to be a connected story with the same characters, or could it be, you know, a bunch of stories just set in the same world where,
like, so,
you know, more of like an,
like the Silmarillion or something,
or like an anthology, you know, like, would you say that it's the Sherlock Holmes series? Like that was something that was puzzling me a little bit.
I mean, I think that would be interesting to talk about, because things like that have their own like pros and cons, especially like the Sherlock Holmes series is a great example, given how many different writers it's had, but it's supposedly the same character in each book, that kind of thing. So, I mean, I'd be fine with it. I haven't read any of them, so I wouldn't contribute much to that conversation, but I'd be interested to hear about it.
Well, even if we just confine the Sherlock discussion to like the original, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle stories, there's a lot of them. I'd say you could qualify it as a series. Like, my instinct is that I wouldn't immediately consider it one, because I don't really get much feeling that those stories take place in the same universe. Like, they reference each other occasionally, but it doesn't really feel like they build on each other in any way. Most of the time. There are some exceptions. Like, you can definitely see that Sherlock's, like, attitude kind of changes the further you get into the stories. But, like, as opposed to something like Discworld, which is a bunch of, you know, quasi-independent storylines all in the same setting, I would qualify that as a series, because it's pretty clear that most of those books, like, take each other into account when you're reading them, except for maybe some of the early ones. But I'm certainly not going to gatekeep on this. I'd be happy to talk about Sherlock as a series, if that's what we're going for. But the most traditional series is, like, following, you know, one character or one group of characters over a single, like, you know, overarching storyline that goes from the beginning of the first book to the end of the last one. Yeah, so that's my standard. And one of the first, like, really long book series that I got into was The Wheel of Time. Ari, I know you've read that one too.
Yes, I have.
How many times have you read it, Ari?
Oh, no, God. One was enough. Okay. I think I got to book 9 out of 11, or I was two away from finishing the series, and I've never gone back.
Yeah, there are, I think, a total of 14 books. I got to 9, and 9 was, like, the last one that was out at the time, and I just did not pick up the 10th one when it came out. I was done by then. This is interesting. One of the first things I noticed about Wheel of Time, and I actually did a reread of it fairly recently, is that the first book feels like a standalone story.
Yeah. Agreed.
Like, if you're not paying super close attention, it really feels that at the end, like, they won. They defeated the Dark Lord, whatever his name
that
is.
That guy.
That guy. I think it's just called the Dark One, actually. I don't think he has a name. Maybe
someone will tell us.
I'll check it in. I'll put it in the show notes if he has a name. But, like, it really seemed like Rand defeated him, right? And, like, Rand had his, like, complete story arc of, like, going from farm boy to badass magic warrior, and then it keeps going. And they were like, no, like, that guy was not the Dark One. That was one of his, like, friends, you know. It was like his lieutenant or something.
Yeah, there were like 9 of them or something like that. It was a very large number that I was like not really prepared for, because I had the exact same experience where I'm like, okay, this was a good book, I had fun with this, and then it's like, well, we got like 8 more of these people to kill, and it's like, oh, well, I guess we're in for the long haul.
Yeah, so because they had like a bunch of disciples, if I recall correctly, and I think it was like even like 13 of them. I don't remember if it was like we have to kill each of them in order, or if it was just that was just the excuse for who it was that Rand fought in the first book.
Yeah.
Because
I think it was just you had to, like there those bad people were still out there, so we still gotta, like, get rid of them. And so I think it was just kind of their setup for being like, well, okay, we killed one bad guy, but there's, like, a bunch of others of equal or stronger power level for you to fight. So, like, you know, come back and read the rest of our books.
Well, I do think that, like, as much as I like to, you know, I like to deride Wheel of Time, as you can probably tell, I do think it has some strengths going for it. I do think that even though its world is not terribly innovative, there is something compelling about it. Like, people, there's no question that Wheel of Time fans are very interested in the world, right? Even though, and, like, the world is you know, kind of your run-of-the-mill fantasy world, it is clearly very detailed, and, like, if not well thought out, certainly there is a lot of thought put into it, and, like, it's extremely complex, right? Yes. And that certainly appeals to a certain number mm-hmm. of readers.
I'd certainly agree with that. I think there's a lot of, like, ideas that people are very intrigued by, like the inherent corruption of magic.
Yeah.
Is, like, a mm-hmm. very... I like that. That's something that I find interesting. And I think that's a big part of it that, like, makes people, like, gravitate to Rand as a character. It's kind of like every time he uses his cool magic, it's, like, slowly, like turning him to the dark side, pretty much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty cool. And then there's the general or whatever. I keep wanting to call him like Merry or Pippin or whatever, but that's just who he reminds me of. And he's like the everyman in the story, where he just hates magic and he's stuck in this world full of magic that is weird and different. And I think there's just like a lot of there's a lot of cool ideas there that I can definitely see gravitating drawing readers in, and like a lot of different types of readers, ones that may like resonate with stuff they're going through in their life. So I can see how
The Matt character, that's the guy you're thinking of, the guy who has like no magic, but he's like just sort of he's at least in theory sort of the normal guy mm-hmm. who has to do stuff right now. Of course, he's anything but normal. He actually has a superpower, is that he's extremely lucky.
Yep.
Which I guess doesn't count as magic.
Everybody would want that.
Luck is very different from magic in some, and actually a fair number of settings. It's kind of weird. Luck is like this own like cosmic force, pretty much.
And like I definitely agree that that the whole corruption of magic with Rand is very compelling. It's unfortunate. I mean, part of the problem with the series is the way that its magic is so unnecessarily gendered, and like creates that, and so it's like only the man magic that's corrupted. So I think you should probably leave that behind. But the idea of magic as being both very powerful but having this like really terrible cost that it exacts, that's not a bad one, and that does like create a pretty natural, you know, back and forth that the main character has to deal with, even after the first book when he's kind of gone through his initial arc.
What's also nice about those kind of high fantasy settings with, you know, like magic and other kind of components like that is how, I mean, it's drawing on like a familiar genre, right? And so like you're able to like be comforted by things that are familiar, but then intrigued by how like the author's playing with it, right? So like the idea that magic corrupts isn't necessarily like novel, but experiencing how it's going mm-hmm. to happen to these characters in this series really makes it compelling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of fun to see how like longer series can take, I don't know, like tropes or just shared genre characteristics and kind of play with them. I think that's where we get like, we, you know, feel like we need to read the next one because we're hooked on what the answer is, how it's going to present something maybe new to us.
Yeah, the longer your series goes, definitely the more you can ask of your reader to keep in their head. And fantasy also has the advantage, at least for fantasy readers, that there's a lot of common mm-hmm. tropes that you can just say, well, this is in my fantasy series. You don't have to spend a lot of time explaining it, because most fantasy readers will be like, okay, I get it. There are dragons, there's magic, there's elves, or whatever, all those things. You know, Lord of the, like, books don't have to stop and say, this is why there are elves.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, this is a fantasy series. Yeah, it has elves. That's normal. So
it's what we do.
Yeah. That kind of thing really lowers it. It takes a lot of the load off of the author having to, you know, do this information dump to kind of explain their world, because they can just kind of focus on what makes their world different and interesting rather than what makes it fantasy.
Yeah.
I also think Wheel of Time is a good example of both how to set up kind of a deep world that will pan out later versus a point where the author had to like invent a new bad guy to fill out a book. Mm-hmm. Because there are like plot seeds that they plant at like the very beginning that pay off way later. Like they talk about how the area that Rand is from, like that village that, and like the villages around it, used to be part of this big empire. Yeah. And that's like a really deep plot point that later comes up when that area finds itself like under attack and they like join together and are like, we're going to be that empire again. And that causes problems, right? And so that was really cool. What was less cool was when like they invented an enemy from across the ocean to come and fill out a few books, right?
Yeah, why wouldn't you? I mean, that the ocean's scary, and you know, we'll just put some foreigners on your shore and there we go. Boom.
Yeah, it was like, who are these guys? These guys feel like they came a bit out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. To like, you know, to occupy the main characters for a bit while they grow in power.
Well, and that right there is probably a good moment to just kind of pull out of the Wheel of Time series and just talk about a big lesson I think from a lot of series and kind of what makes some better than others. You know, Oren, you said Wheel of Time mm-hmm. starts off with a book that seems like it could be a standalone book. And, you know, series that are written as a series tend to keep a tighter through line, you know, and you have less likely chance of just random things coming out of the ocean and whatnot. You know, it might be properly foreshadowed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that I've noticed with other books. I remember I picked up Dune. I was ready to go with like all the Dune books, and a friend's dad said, just read the first one and then move on. You know, and that was great advice. I don't feel like I missed anything. I was very satisfied with having read the first book, and I felt like I could go try something else instead of seeing, you know, what else Frank and his son got paid to write.
Yeah, that's certainly true. There's actually a book series. Here it is. A book series that fits that to a T. The Hyperion series.
Oh my god, I was just thinking that.
That I was just, yeah, as soon as you said, don't read past the first one, the Hyperion series is, I think it's pretty old, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Dan Simmons kind of like wrote that in like the 80s, maybe? Someone can let us know.
Yeah, it's kind of like a classic sci-fi story that was recommended to me by someone. They didn't tell me to stop reading after the second book, but you should definitely stop reading after the second book because it's a... Like, the story ends after the second book. They win. One of the characters finishes their arc. The big monster is fought and somewhat defeated. You know, they go through their whole resolution. All the storylines are ended. And then it goes for two more books. And it launches into this really weird, the space Catholic Church is evil. And their Pope is immortal because of some weird parasite that they use. And
yeah, you know, the immortality parasite. Yeah. Like, you can pick one up at the drugstore.
Just have one. And, like, they go to, like computers run everything, and they have their own special computer world that you can, like, go into. And apparently computers just rebuilt Earth, because Earth was destroyed at one point. And the computers just rebuilt it, or saved it, or something to it. Earth is back.
Yeah.
And it's just very weird, and it's just, like, it feels like a completely different series, and a... very bad series. It's just I highly recommend the first two Hyperion books. They're great. Stop there. If you haven't read them, and if you like sci-fi, it doesn't feel old in a way where like a lot of old stories can sometimes have things that are problematic, or they just don't really... writing has gotten better, and so old stories definitely feel like things that we have learned haven't been implemented. Hyperion doesn't feel that way. It feels really good. Yeah. Just stop after the second book.
I mean, I feel like Ender's Game is another one that's kind of like that.
I was just thinking that.
I was just going to say, I haven't actually read anything past Ender's Game. I was curious, that's not true. I tried to read Speaker for the Dead, and I couldn't get through it.
Ender's Game is a really interesting book series because it forks after the first book mm-hmm. series, and your natural inclination would be to continue from Ender's Game to Speaker of the Dead because that's Ender's story, but... for a lot of folks, I mean, really what they wanted was more Ender's Game. And Speakers for the Dead, I read it a long time ago, never felt the need to go back and do it again. It's just very different. I've heard a lot of people say that Speaker for the Dead is a legitimately good book. It's just a different book than what most people wanted. I haven't really heard anyone defend the later ones, like Xenocide and the last one, whatever it was called. But then there's the Bean books.
That other
book. Shadows of Ender's Shadow... all the other shadow names, the Bean books, they're the other fork, and that's really where you want to go from Ender's Game, is you want to start reading the Bean series, which I really like. I would recommend that to anyone. I would recommend buy it used. Don't support Orson Scott Card. Don't ever buy anything of his new. He's a terrible monster. But he does write some good books, so buy it used or acquire it in some other method and read the Bean books. They're good.
A book series that I found, and granted, it's been a while since I've read these, but that I found were, I think, worked pretty well despite not really having that much of an overarching plot, were the Dragons of Pern.
I think I read the first one of that one. It didn't grab me for whatever reason. I'm not sure why.
Yeah, it's been a long time, and like maybe if I picked one up now, I wouldn't like it. But when I was a kid, I was like really into these books. And I don't think I even read them in the right order. Because like it used to be hard to tell what orders books were supposed to be read in. Nope. Like Brecken Marjorie. You know, there was a time when you couldn't just Google that. Yep. Like, I know that sounds weird to say now, but you used to have to try to figure out which book came in which order, and the book didn't always say that on the cover, right?
Also, some books would have it where they would only, like, when that book was printed, maybe they weren't sure how many they were going to have, so it only had up to a certain number, and then you'd have to go find later printed books, which would have the whole series in order, like, on the inside the cover. The Dresden Files did that. The Honorverse has that, because they're both just very long series.
Yeah, so I don't think I read the Dragon Riders of Pern in order, but, and like, it's basically a bunch of smaller stories inside what is a fairly generic fantasy world, but with one, like, very interesting difference, which is the whole idea that, like, every so often, like, acid worms fall from the sky. And, you know, that's like, the big thing that makes it feel different, and the only way to fight the acid worms falling from the sky is with dragons.
Sure. Why not?
Yeah, makes sense.
Right?
I like it.
Yeah, that's what you, like you do. And you also find out eventually that it's actually a sci-fi setting, because it's, like, one of those, we came to a planet and lost all of our technology, but we used it to create dragons first.
Great use.
Yeah, yeah. So, and, like, again, like that series, like, they have one, like, they've got your standard, like, okay, we have to fight the acid worms plot. Like, that's, like, one plot that they have. And then they have another plot where they're like, okay, so this isn't... The acid worms aren't even in this series. This series is just about, like, a really jerk noble guy who is, like, running his fiefdom into the ground and, like, you know, really making people's lives miserable. And we're, like, trying to figure out how to get rid of him without causing a war, right? Mm-hmm. And then they've got the story that's just about this bard, like, in that world. He's just, you know, he's a bard. I think he's called a harper or whatever. And again, he doesn't even ride dragons. So it's like that series, I felt like it was a world that was big enough to contain multiple stories. And so, like, each story didn't have to top the story that came before, right? Mm-hmm. It could be different.
Yep.
Which frees it from some of the problems that you see in really long series where it's like, oh man, last book, we cleansed magic of the Dark One's power and, like, we defeated the bad guys from across the sea. How does the next book top that?
Yeah.
Where do we go from here? Kind of problem.
Yeah, yeah. And I felt like the Dragon Riders of Pern did that fairly well, just, like, creating a world and, again, not a particularly original world, but, I mean, whatever. I think that as long as you do something, if you do something well, I think that goes a long way towards, you know, being okay that it's not super original.
Yeah, sure,
right?
Definitely. You know, like, since you talk about series from childhood, you know, like, Redwall comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about
it. Wow. It's that same kind of story. It's like, it's an intriguing world. We've got, you know, animals with swords. Awesome. But also, you could... You know, it's that childhood problem of, like, what's in my elementary school library? And you don't know what order they come in. You know that they're the Redwall books, and so you just grab one and go, right?
Yeah, well, if I recall correctly, the Redwall books are, like, there are a handful of connected stories, but most of them are super standalone, right?
If I remember correctly, it's been years since I read a Redwall book, though. I used to read those all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Redwall has certainly made a really strong cultural impression. Like, when I'm trying to explain Mouse Guard, it is both a blessing and a curse, because I can, like, lean on Redwall and be like, it's kind of like Redwall, but then, like, it's also not exactly like Redwall, and so that leads players to make certain assumptions when they think about Redwall versus Mouse Guard, and they're like, okay, I want to be a badger, and it's like, you can't be a badger in Mouse Guard. The badgers are, like, you know, a goddamn elephant compared to a mouse. You can't play one.
No. How much food porn are we going to have? Because, like, Redwall tricked me into thinking a lot of food would be delicious when it was not.
No. It's like there's the Game of Thrones. I like to contrast Game of Thrones and Redwall because Game of Thrones makes me think that food that I love is disgusting. Because, like, in Game of Thrones, they basically eat bread, meat, and cheese. But which is, like, my staples, right? I love bread, meat, and cheese. But the way that they describe it makes it sound really unappetizing. And it's like, I don't want to eat that. No, thank you. Whereas Redwall, it's like, yeah, we put, like, some roots in a pie, and it sounds like the most delicious thing that anybody has ever made. Yep. And I'm just like, I would actually hate that if someone actually gave it to me.
You know,
just describe it to me, and I'll enjoy it.
Somebody might need to verify this, but I remember hearing that like one of the reasons why like the description of like the food is so good and other things in those series is that Brian Jacques like wrote them to be read out loud, because I can't remember if it was like his kid or he was close with somebody who was blind, and so he wanted to have a lot more like sensory words in the text to try to like paint better like pictures or descriptions of it.
Oh,
of course,
cool.
That could just be folklore. Who knows at this point? But
well, if that is the case, it certainly worked for me because I started those being read. My mother read them to me because I didn't really like reading when I was really young. So Redwall, like things like Redwall and like The Magic Treehouse and stuff like that. Those were my childhood reading staples, and it was very evocative. You know, there are lots of problems with the Redwall books, but the text is definitely good at bringing the world alive.
Yeah. Yeah, Redwall shows both the advantages and the weaknesses of relying on a formula, because the books are very formulaic, right? Which, on the one hand, like, you can be pretty guaranteed that, like, at least, again, it's been a while, but I don't really recall thinking this Redwall book is worse than the last Redwall book.
Yeah.
Like, I remember their quality level being really consistent. Like, there were a few that I liked more than others. Like, I really liked the one about, what's the lady who goes by Gullwhacker? I forget her first name, but anyway, like, I really liked the stories about her. But I think that was more just because there were so few Redwall stories about a female character that they really stood out to me than because they were better written. But at the same time, once you read enough Redwall books, they start to get really predictable.
Yep.
Right. And that's a problem if you want people to read, like, your giant epic-spanning series, right?
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think it helps if it's targeted at kids. Kids probably are less likely to pick up on that.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I didn't. I was just like, this is awesome. You know, people actually, like it was really cool to me, because, like, normally in the books, the good guys always live and, like, win the day. And in Redwall, some of the good guys die. And that was cool to me.
Yeah, that's true.
As a child. Now it's just like, well, you know. Like, every time, like, I can pretty much guess I can kind of play guess the, you know, the token death character. But as a kid, that was awesome. I did not think about it that way. And now maybe that'll be different, because we have more options in fantasy now than when I was a kid. So maybe children will become a more discerning audience than I was as a child.
There was also there was a lot of, repetition in, like, finding the magic sword. Mm-hmm. Although never like to the same extent as it was in the first book, but there was still a lot of stories depended on like, well, we need to find the MacGuffin. And those stories, again, like those are interesting stories, and especially they provide a lot of novelty for kids, right? But if you get a little older, like even into like the teenager range, and you start reading those books, you're like, wait a minute, I know what they're gonna do here. They're gonna find a magic sword.
Come on to you, Redwall.
Yeah, yeah. Not actually magic, but you know what I mean, right?
Maybe it's, like, the only good sword. Like, all of their steel is really bad. So, like, it's, like, the one really quality sword. So everyone thinks it's magic, but it's just a good sword.
Yeah, just a really nice sword. Well, it's apparently made out of a meteor, which, you know, in reality, meteoric iron is actually lower quality than most iron you would mine out of the ground, but, you know.
Don't tell Avatar the Last Airbender that. Sokka would be very disappointed.
I would never disappoint Sokka like that. All right, so that we are at the end of our time for this episode, and as you can tell, we have barely scratched the surface of our discussion of long series, so we will be back next time for part two of our discussion of long book series. Ari, thank you for joining us for this episode.
Of course, thank you for having me.
If those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to slip us some gold press latinum, head over to patreon.com/mythcreants. We appreciate it. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry.
This has been the Mythcreant Podcast. Opening and closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.